Turn to Romans, the 12th chapter and verse 10. I want to show you a rare word. Brother Burke, you don't happen to know how many times the word philostorgo, do you know how many times that occurs in the New Testament? It's rare, isn't it? It's philostorgo is a kindly affection to be devoted to one another. I should have. You know, it's a rare word. I think, perhaps, that this is the only time that it's found in the New Testament. The 10th chapter. Philostorgoi. No wonder you didn't recognize it. Philostorgoi. It means to be devoted to. It's a combination of phileo and storge, and it's a. In my translation, it's not even translated as anything but love. Love one another with brotherly affection. But in the NIV, it's translated, be devoted to one another. Be devoted to one another. And it involves the word Philadelphia, which is another facet of the word love, not the word agape, but the word, in fact, the word agape doesn't occur in that verse. And yet the word love is twice mentioned here. Love one another with brotherly affection is mentioned once, and the word brotherly affection there, translating the word that we just mentioned. But you think about being devoted to, and sometimes words lose their meaning. We talk about devotion, and perhaps devotion hasn't lost its meaning as much even as the word love has lost its meaning, and it's become clouded and become fuzzy. But the translation, to be devoted to one another in brotherly affection or brotherly love, is an expression that we ought to give attention to. When I think of devotion, I think of certain people. When you think of devotion, if you'll think for just a moment, you'll call to mind certain people. She's devoted, or he's devoted. Hopefully it will be to people rather than to things. But when I think of devotion, I think of the Halliburton family of Winchester, Tennessee. They are the parents of a girl. She's not living now. But she died when she was about 40, 37 or 38, around the age 40. She was totally spastic all her life. She was born a complete invalid. And she could do nothing for herself. She was at the mercy completely of other people. Her mother, of course, first. Her father, right along beside her mother. Both of these people were Christians. Anne herself was a Christian. Brilliant mind, but locked in a body that could do nothing. I think of Mrs. Halley, as we called her. Mrs. Halley was so devoted to that daughter. And Anne never lacked anything as far as what other children had. Her mother always dressed her in the finest clothing, always up to date and in style. Whenever the styles changed, Anne's clothing changed. Whenever she, I remember, and this has been 40 years ago, I remember the shoes that she used to wear. She used to have pink house slippers. Her mother kept her in house slippers that were clean and all. I remember those pink house slippers. I remember her fingernails were just manicured to the nth degree. They were always painted with some kind of a modest fingernail polish. I think of Mrs. Halliburton as being devoted to her daughter. And it's a beautiful picture of this lovely mother who could always be on call. For almost 40 years, she was devoted to this girl. Her whole life was wrapped up around this girl. Mrs. Huff, who lives on Center Street here, was our next door neighbor. She had a similar daughter. They reminded me much of each other. And Mrs. Huff was devoted to her daughter, Rebecca. And she spent 36 years of her life wrapped around that daughter. And she gave the same kind of genuine care for that daughter. And it reminds me of a verse in 1 Peter 5:7, which says, casting all your anxieties upon him because he cares for you. That word really should be translated, he cares about you. Anne was a person who had been cared, not only cared for, but she was cared about. Now, to be devoted to someone would imply to be to care about them. You can care for someone's needs and not care about the person. But that's what comes to my mind first. But there's another side of that story. And I told this congregation some 4 or 5 years ago the story of Anne Halliburton. My sister Betty and my family, we moved in next door to the Halliburtons. And Betty and Anne were about the same age. And so, as my lovely sister does, she just reaches out to people. And so she went over next door to meet this new neighbor. Though she was the new neighbor, but she went in to meet the girl in the wheelchair. And they just became thick as molasses, just thick as thieves, as friends. They just couldn't be separated. And every day after school, Betty would make a beeline to Ann's, and they would just sit there and talk, though Ann couldn't talk. Well, she could. Nobody could understand her, though. Her mother could understand her. But Betty got to where she could understand her better than her own mother. And her mother would have to ask Betty, Betty, what did she say? And Betty would tell her what Ann, her daughter, had said. Now, that's devotion. For a young girl in the, 13, 14, 15 years old, 16, right in the prime of her teenage years, to spend those afternoons in the home of a girl in a wheelchair, talking to her about girl things, that's devotion. But there's still a footnote to that. We moved away. And my sister Betty wrote to Anne 2 times every week for 20 years. 3,500 letters, I figured up. That's about 3,500 letters that she wrote to that girl. Now, that's devotion. That's devotion. For a boy, that would be absolute, that's an impossibility. And I see you girls nod your head. Boys don't write. 80% of the letters I get are always, they're from girls. You know why? Well, because girls write. But anyway, that's devotion that this girl showed to that other girl. The girl, Anne, died. And you know how long her mother lived after she died? About a year. Because that around which she had wrapped her life and had spent her whole energy in glorifying God was now gone. And I guess the mother just felt like that her life's mission had been accomplished. I think of that when I think of devotion. I also think of Elizabeth Barrett Browning when I think of devotion. It's another kind of devotion. It's a devotion between a man and his wife. And I don't know when Sonnet 43 was written, but I think, well, I'm not sure it was after they were married or before. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach when feeling out of sight for the ends of being an ideal grace. I love thee to the level of everyday's most quiet need by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. I love thee with the passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with a love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears of all my life. And if God chooses, I shall but love thee better after death. That's what I think of when I think of devotion. I think of a statement by Aristides, a philosopher, a Christian philosopher, about 125 A.D., as he describes some things about the Christians of the second century that relate to what our recent series has been. As he described those people, he says they walk in all humility and kindness, and falsehood is not found among them, and they love one another. They despise not the widow and grieve not the orphan. He that has distributes liberally to him that has not. If they see a stranger, they bring him under their roof and rejoice over him as if he were their own brother. For they call him themselves brethren, not after the flesh, but after the Spirit and in God. But when one of their poor passes away from the world and any of them see him, then he provides for his burial according to his ability. And if they hear that any of their members are imprisoned or oppressed for the name of their Messiah, all of them provide for his needs, and if it is possible that he may be delivered, they deliver him. And if there is among them a man that's poor and needy, and they have not an abundance of necessities, they fast 2 or 3 days that they may supply the needy with their necessary food. Now that's devotion. Be devoted to one another with brotherly affection. These are descriptions of devotion. We've studied recently Acts 2, 41 and 42 and 47, where it says the believers were together and had all things common. They sold their possessions and distributed them according to every man's need. There wasn't a needy person among them. Those that were possessors of lands and houses, and you know the story of how they were devoted to one another's well-being. And all of these that I've spoken about, the ones in Acts, the statement by Aristides, the statement by Elizabeth Barrett Browning, as she reflected his devotion toward her, and that's another whole story you could go into, but as all of this is reflected and these different levels, and you see Betty's devotion toward Anne and Anne's mother, her devotion toward Anne, and all of these different levels of devotion, and then I think of Bill's sister's husband, Bill Harris's sister's husband. Bill, how long did she have multiple sclerosis? 42 years this woman had multiple sclerosis, and her husband just simply devoted his life to that one's care. You know, that's a beautiful quality, and it needs to be emulated in the life of every one of us. These are all different relationships. They're different levels. Sometimes we get our priorities of devotion mixed up. And religious people, it seems more so maybe than, or as much as anybody else, we get our priorities mixed up. In Matthew, the 15th chapter, do you remember something in the life of the Jewish people? We're not going to study from it. Let me just refer to it. You remember the Korban issue? You know what the word Korban means? It means devoted. Devoted to God. Well, that's not all that bad, is it? Well, it was the way they were using it. Because, you see, they were misusing it. They had their priorities turned around. The Jewish people were using this custom or this tradition as a means of getting around showing devotion to their mother and daddy. The law had required you show devotion to your mother and daddy. You honor them. But they said, what you might have been profited from me has been korban. It's been given to God. It's been devoted to God. And therefore, I can't help you. I can't support you. Jesus said, you hypocrite. Isaiah really knew about you when he said, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. You see, they all had simply, they just gotten their priorities mixed up, their priorities of devotion. Now, the New Testament speaks of priorities of devotion. And in Galatians, the 6th chapter and verse 10, it says, as you have opportunity, let's do what? Do good to whom? To all men, but especially whom? Especially those of the household of faith. Now that simply states priorities of devotion. In 1 Timothy 5 and 8, the writer there, writing to Timothy, said that we ought to take care of our relatives, and especially of our own household. And if any man does not provide for his own family, he has denied the faith. He's worse than an infidel. Now there, he separates even your relatives from your own family. Relatives be in-laws and others who are related to us, but he says, now, especially your own family, your wife and your sons and your daughters, this is a primary relationship. This is a primary responsibility. So actually, in these two verses, you have some gradations of devotion. All men, as you have opportunity, but especially those of the household of faith, and then all of your relatives generally, but especially your own family. So it keeps narrowing it down and pinpointing it, and it brings it to rest at the door of that part of society that we most often fail to recognize as being worthy of our devotion. And sometimes we love them only in word and not in deed. And I'm not saying that that's a blanket condemnation at all or an assessment, but so often it happens that we don't give the right kind of devotion to the right people. When I was young and stupid, at that age, about 22 or 23, as a preacher, and you're sometimes doubly stupid when you're a preacher at that age, you think you've got all the answers and you don't have any of them. You don't even know what the questions are. Our first child was born, as our children were always born, 90% of them were, Sunday morning about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'd get up and I'd look like I'd been, mauled. But anyway, this one was born, and Louine had 23 hours of labor with him, Tim. And I didn't know. I thought it was normal to have 23 hours of labor. But that's not normal. She almost died. And the day I went to get her and take her home, we came home with the little thing. He was so ugly. I wanted to trade him off. I thought maybe we could trade him. He cleared up, though, and he looked all right finally, but he was so terribly ugly at first. But anyway, we came home with him. She brought him in, and if my memory serves me correctly, she didn't even take off her coat. She sat down on the couch because she was weak. And I sat there twiddling my thumbs. And I said in about 10 or 15 minutes, well, I've got to go. And she said, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to visit the sick. And she cried the rest of the whole day. And I don't wonder why. Later on, when I regained part of my sanity, I made a decision. And that decision was, as I looked and saw my three boys, that's all we had at that time, and those little stair steps, I made a decision that I was, with God's help, going to turn my life around, and I was going to be a father and a husband first and a preacher second. And I've told you about that decision. And I wouldn't take for making that decision. It's the finest thing I ever did in my life, I guess, other than become a Christian. James Dobson, in some of his recent material on the family, talks about this. He and his wife just had a real knockdown drag out. It was really serious. And you know over what? Over his being gone, in and out, day in and day out, gone on this mission, speaking over here, preaching over here, lecturing over here on the family now. This is a family man. He's talking about how to raise your family. And you know what? Some people who are experts on family are gone so much telling other folks how to raise their family that their own family goes to hell. Well, he was doing that, and so she had brought it home to him and said, you're not doing right. And so one day, though, his father died. His father was a preacher, a dedicated man. And he went to the funeral, and as he was driving to the funeral with his wife, she saw him musing or looking out the window, and she said, what are you thinking about? And he said, I'm just thinking about all the good times my father and I had together. And the best times of my life were those times when my father and I would go down in the woods hunting squirrels. And my father would set me on this stump or leave me there in the woods, and he'd go around the trees and he'd scare up those squirrels, and so I could get a shot at them. He said, I was just thinking about that. And then he made the statement out of the conversation that they had had earlier about his being so involved. He said, I wonder what my children are going to remember about me. He said, I wonder if they'll remember that, oh, yes, James Dobson was over here lecturing on the family, and he was over here speaking, and he was over here at this retreat. I doubt that they'll remember any of that, he said. Mixed up priorities. May God forgive us. We've got some mixed up priorities. The devotion that we have toward one another, where does it fit into all this? And where does it come in this list of priorities? In Romans, the 12th chapter and verse 10, there is one statement. Not all of these are couplets. Some of these are couplets. Let love be genuine, and hate what's evil, hold fast to what's good is a couplet that is bound to let love be genuine. Love one another with brotherly affection is part of a couplet, I think, with the next part, outdo one another in showing honor. Now, I think that's a couplet. But the first part of that, verse 10a, says, it speaks of affection. The word agape is not there. The word phileo is there, or a derivative of it. And the word agape is the highest form of love, but the word phileo gets down to where we live in the sense of affections and emotions and attachments and things that are warm and responsive because of it's more human, the phileo kind of love, and it's honorable. And when we're told to honor one another in this respect, when we're told to love one another and be devoted to one another in this kind of affection, I think it encourages the human warmth and the capacity to receive and be received on a basis that's, well, that's emotional. Be devoted to one another with brotherly affection. And the second part of it, he says there, is outdo one another in showing honor. Is there a translation, or is there not a translation that says in honor preferring one another? Is that the place that it doesn't have? It says outdo one another in showing honor. Is this the place where it says in honor preferring one another? It may not be. It is? Yes, it is. In honor preferring one another. I've heard that said, that means we ought to honor Christians above people in the world. Well, now that's true. But that's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about here that I ought to be more interested in honoring you than you, than my interest in your honoring me. In other words, we're to see to it that we are to be givers of honor rather than receivers of honor. And you know where most fights originate? Most fights originate out of selfishness, out of pride, and originate over someone wanting honor rather than being willing to give honor. You just mark it down. You and your wife will do a lot of your fighting and a lot of your arguing over who's going to have his way and who's going to look the best. And the same thing is true with brethren. Many times our arguments come over who's going to receive the honor rather than who's going to give the honor. There are some implications that I want to mention very briefly before I close. There's a statement in 1 John 3:16 and 17 that we've noticed before, but I want to just touch base with it. By this we know devotion. But there the word is love, and I've just used the word devotion because it's synonymous with that. By this we know devotion, or love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. Now that's devotion. And that's our best definition of devotion, is to lay your life down for somebody. Which means that you, again, prefer their needs being met and prefer their rights being provided rather than your own. You lay your life down for them. That's devotion. That's love. And I thought that there are perhaps three areas that would do to think about devotion. I think that devotion comes out in the sense that we not only do what John says here, provide for whatever your brother has need of, verse 17. If anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? The world's goods there, you might think, and I'm sure that's what he had in mind, first of all, and maybe exclusively, but not intentionally exclusive. He has in mind here just the physical things of life, the bread and the food and the rent and the gas money, whatever your brother has need of, and you have some and you don't give it to him. God's love doesn't abide in you. But I think it also would mean, whatever it may be, emotional strength, genuineness, kindness, gentleness, all of these things, an arm of sympathy that could be put around a person, anything that you possess that somebody else needs that you don't give them and you hold yourself back from them. I think he's simply saying anybody who stands aloof from his brother, anyone who stands aloof from his brother, God's love can't abide in that person. Now, then provide whatever it is that you have and somebody else has not. That's what he's saying. But then there are three things that instead of not only do we provide, but I think we're cast into the role of a protector. If you would be devoted to your brother, if you would be devoted to your sister in the Lord or to your sister in the flesh, if you would be devoted to anybody, it means you provide for them whatever they need, but it also means that you protect them. Protect them. For one thing, that you protect their reputation. Protect their reputation. Barnabas was one of those people who protected people's reputation. If you watch that character, you first find him protecting the reputation of Paul. The church didn't want to receive Paul. Barnabas, as a protector of, he was devoted to people. He went out to the where Paul was, standing out there on the outside. He went out there and said to Paul, he interviewed him, tried to find out whether he was real or fake. Come to find out the man was genuine. He went back in and said, you know, he's right, his reputation. He held it up and said, let him alone, he's right, you receive him. Later on, when John Mark's reputation was at stake, who do you find going to bat for John Mark? Barnabas. Because he was one of those men that was devoted to his brethren in brotherly affection. He was a very great man. But then, I think also that being devoted to one another means that we devote ourselves to one another's purity. This has to do primarily with dating. Girls, how do you know whether a boy is devoted to you or not? He may be slobbering all over himself to be with you. You know, he may do the stupidest things and do silly things to get your attention and all that, and you may think he's devoted to you. You don't really know until you find out whether or not he'll protect you, whether he'll protect your purity. Oh, he might be gallant enough to push you out of the way, you know, of a car, or he might be gallant enough to do a lot of things like that, but is he gallant enough and is he devoted enough to you to protect your purity? In Galatians, the 5th chapter, in verse 13, there's a statement there that it's a pretty good safeguard for dating. We're free as Christians. We're free. You were called to freedom, brethren. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh. On a date, you're free, you know. You can go where you want to. You're in a car. You can do what you will. And Christ has given you the freedom. Thank God we have that freedom. But be careful that you don't use it as a pretext for evil or as an opportunity for the flesh. And here's the way, but through love, be servants of one another. And you do that by protecting one another and guarding one another's purity. In Ephesians, the 5th chapter, that's the major one of these references, Ephesians 5, 25 through 27. Listen to this as it talks about the husband's relationship to the wife. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. That's devotion. That he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word. That's devotion. That he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. Ooh, that's devotion. And when you see a man or a boy dating a girl or a man treating his wife in such a way that he sets her apart, he sanctifies her, he sets her apart as something special, and sees to it that she is never spotted or wrinkled or any such thing, he protects her from all such. You know that man's devoted to that woman. And girls, let me just tell you something. You can test him out to see whether he's devoted to you or not. And then I think in a final consideration, that to be devoted to the brotherhood or to be devoted to one another would mean devoting ourselves to guarding and protecting each other's opinions, each other's feelings, each other's conscience. The whole 14th chapter of Romans talks about being careful about other people's feelings and how different people are different ways, and some are meat eaters and others are vegetarians, and some observe one day alike above others and others observe all days alike. And he just said, you just make sure that you receive him. Welcome him. As for the man who's weak in faith, welcome him, but not for disputes over opinions. Don't get him in there then to wrangle about his opinions. And then he just goes on in chapter 15, verse 1, says, we who are strong ought to bear the failings of the weak and not please ourselves. See, devotion to one another's feelings, devotion to one another's right to an opinion, devotion to one another's feelings and to one another's conscience. So we find ourselves right in the middle of Christianity when we talk about devotion. And the only way we know devotion really in its fullest sense is to see Jesus Christ as he was devoted. He was devoted to his friends. He was devoted to his enemies. He was devoted to God. He showed us the way to be devoted. And may I just urge you now to remember your priorities and get them right. And then once you've got your priorities right, preachers and all the others of us, you know, get your family in there. They must come in there first, and then people next, and then on. And this doesn't speak against these other relationships. It just simply says, in priority, you've got responsibility to your family first. And then as it bleeds on out into the other members of the body and other members of the church, then protect them, provide for them. Care for their feelings, care for their opinion, care for their reputation, guard them, protect them, stand at their back. That's being devoted. And I just pray that God might develop that among us. I receive letters occasionally from people outside town, outside the city here, who are not members of this congregation, but who are upset with me for one reason or another. And you can't say anything in public or write anything without somebody taking exception to it. And I'm all right with that. I don't mind. But I do mind when I find in brethren an attitude that shows me that they're not really devoted to my best interest. Who will seize upon anything that's in writing or anything that's in the spoken word and seize upon it and disregard all the qualifying statements around it and just lift it out of its context and then broadcast this around, you know those people are not really interested in your well-being. I received a letter last week from a man who is very much opposed to me in a position that I take. But don't you know what? He wrote to me and he said, I want to know whether this is what you mean. If this is the position you hold, because, he said, I don't want to misrepresent you in what you believe. And I fell in love with the old character. I don't even know him. But I wrote him a letter and I said, dear brother, thank you for writing. Because not everybody takes the time to just simply protect my reputation and to protect my best interest, to protect my name. And I believe that, brother, though he differs from me in this respect, I believe that he's devoted to me. And he's seen a quality in the Lord, and he has discerned a quality of the Christian life that's so real and yet so often rare. Would you commit yourself tonight to be devoted to one another? That's what Paul says here. I'm going to ask you right now, if you'll just think for a moment, will you be devoted to one another in brotherly affection? Will you do that for one another? The person sitting beside you, the one back of you, the one in front of you, will you commit yourself to that tonight? Man alive, people can't stand to be outside a fellowship that's devoted to one another in brotherly affection. May God bless us in these thoughts. We're going to sing this song of encouragement. And if you'd like to be a part of a body like that, we're striving to be like that. We're not there yet. Come in faith. Turn your life over to Jesus. Be immersed into him. Be raised to walk a new life. If you're here and you're a Christian and you need to make some corrections in your life, that's your opportunity now. We're going to sing this song to encourage you. Let us stand.